I'm here tonight to talk about this new book of mine, The Age of Reagan, A History. How can you write the history of things that have happened yesterday? Well, I tried. I wrote this book, well, first of all, it's something of an anomaly for those of you who have any acquaintance at all with my own work. Certainly my friends think it's an anomaly. As Susan said, I write a lot of history, and most of my history writing is about the early 19th century. It's about Thomas Jefferson and Andrew Jackson and all the way to Abraham Lincoln. And then I also write about politics in ways that would not automatically lead you to assume that I'd be writing about Ronald Reagan, let alone writing appreciatively about Ronald Reagan, which I end up doing. But I had some very specific ideas in mind. First of all, it struck me, that we have been living through a distinct age in American politics, a conservative age in American politics. That it's not simply, you know, one president or one administration or one Congress or one election after another, but that really we can talk about this as a conservative age. If the period from 1933 to the late 1960s, the birth of the New Deal, the fall of the Great Society, if that was a period of liberal reform, then the last 35 years have certainly been an era of conservatism. And I wanted to write about that era as an era. That was really why I got into this, that it struck me that something had gone on which was not just happenstance, but that was profound and important. And I wanted to try and write, as I normally do in a narrative form, but to write a fresh, fairly succinct, an accessible chronicle of that era, attempting to explain how it came to be, what it did, and then what its legacy has been. Now, I've been told that the conservatives of the New York Public Library who show up for these talks have done all the reading. I wish I could say about as much about my students down in Princeton, but I won't. Knowing that, I won't bore you with a plot summary of this book. Not that I would want to do the plot summary of a book that's 576 pages long anyway, which for me is actually short. I wrote short. The last one was a doorstop. This is a svelte doorstop. But I wanted to write this book about a conservative era in which I was pretty sure that one figure really was the central figure, and that was Ronald Reagan. That he really was the most important figure of the age, at least as far as politics is concerned. In fact, it struck me as odd that it's taken so long for historians to write seriously about Ronald Reagan, his administration, and the larger conservative age. When you think about it, it didn't take historians that long. It hasn't taken historians that long in the past. When Franklin Delano Roosevelt died in office in 1945. Within 3 years, a young, ambitious, and extremely talented young historian named Richard Hofstadter already wrote an overview, a brief overview, in the last chapter of his well-known book, The American Political Tradition, on Roosevelt's administration. Over the following years, such distinguished historians as Eric Goldman, Frank Friedel, James McGregor Burns, and finally Arthur Schlesinger Jr., who in 1957 published the first volume of his projected multi-volumed series, The Age of Roosevelt, and I must admit I did swipe part of the title from Arthur, but we'll get onto that later. That came out in 1957, only 12 years after FDR was gone. Now, it has taken much, much longer for historians to write about Ronald Reagan. Why that is, I've suggested in my preface, that we can talk about that later on, why it's taken historians so long. I think it's in part has to do with the nature of Ronald Reagan, and in part it has to do with the nature of historians. But we'll talk about that later, if you'd like. In seeing Reagan, though, as the central figure, I also wanted to take a somewhat longer view, this idea, as I say, of an era, to expand the chronological focus outside of Ronald Reagan's two administrations and to move it outside of Ronald Reagan himself. There is a very interesting, actually, biography of Ronald Reagan, his authorized biography, in which the author, Edmund Morris, a very distinguished biographer of Theodore Roosevelt, made some odd literary choices, which make it difficult to quite understand what's true and what's not. Although I think there's a lot in there that's very, very interesting. It helped me out a great deal. But I wanted to get it off of this figure while also studying this figure. And the way to do that, I thought, was to enlarge the chronological frame, to see the age of Reagan as something that had a buildup, a culmination, and a legacy. As I started researching the book, I came to discover or rediscover that pundits of one variety or another had been writing off Ronald Reagan for as long as Ronald Reagan was in public life. And indeed, some very distinguished, again, some very important political observers wrote off the Reagan era before it, or barely after it had just begun. In 1982, I was so stunned to see a quotation from David Broder describing Reaganism as a, quote, one-year phenomenon. That it was that the Reagan administration, and this is in 1982, he is writing, had already passed its phase-out point. Well, we all know that wasn't the case. Indeed, as I say, I think that you can best understand American politics and American history as a unit that began with the fall of Richard Nixon in 1974, and I believe is continued right through the current administration in Washington, and an era that I suspect, no, I know, is coming to an end this year. Historians aren't supposed to predict things. I'm not predicting anything specific. I'm just saying that the world has changed. And how the world is going to end up, I don't know. I remember the movie Network, where they had a fortune teller who came on the end to predict the news for the next week? I'm a historian, not a fortune teller. I don't do that. But something has changed. When, indeed, Ed Rollins, who was Ronald Reagan's political guru, one of his political gurus, says that it's gone. The old Reagan coalition is over. It's gone. He tried to rebuild it, and he tried to rebuild it via Mike Huckabee, which didn't exactly work out either. But the coalition, the old division of forces, has changed. And when that's changed, the politics are going to change. I don't know how they're going to go. They could go in a lot of different directions, but something different is in the air. So that's what this book tries to do, to explain how it came to be, what it was, and where it went. And it begins, I'm going to do a little bit of reading tonight just because I like to read, but also because to try and frame this book, I think the beginning, the prologue, and the epilogue are important. The prologue begins a little bit after the book starts, and the epilogue begins a little bit before the book ends. I'd like to say I did that on, with great forethought. Not exactly, but I wanted to capture two moments that I thought framed the era well, and both happened to have occurred more or less in the same place. So many years apart. So we begin, the prologue actually begins on July 4th, 1976. I know that some of you were around that to see that day. Flags flew, bells rang, and mammoth fireworks bombarded the night. The nation's bicentennial came as a cause for immense celebration, and also as a relief and an escape. After an embittering political decade, culminating in the Watergate crisis, the country seemed to be pulling through. Americans desperately wanted to think so. Their outpouring proclaimed a yearning, for simple unity and a national sense of purpose. At least for a day, disappointment and disorientation gave way to exuberance and old glory. That was what it was like. And I talk about the scene in Lower Manhattan with the big tall ships parade, and how people in New York at that time actually were pessimistic about the future but wanted to believe. wanted to believe very much, wanted this day to stand out because it was the nation's birthday, it was the bicentennial, it was something that they could all hold together, and people said, at least for that one day, they had a feeling of unity. Whether that was a matter of people imagining something that wasn't there or something more real is really beside the point that I wanted to make. It was the yearning for not just a new kind of unity, but a yearning for a new kind of political leadership in the aftermath of Watergate. And indeed, Gerald Ford, who was the president at the time, is quoted, and I quote him in the very next paragraph, saying that as his head hit the pillow, he said to himself, "Well, Jerry, I guess we healed America." Well, that proved to be a little premature. America's healing, in some ways, I think, has not been completed even now, the healing from those years. But what Gerald Ford thought and hoped, for very good reasons, aspired to, would take much, much longer than he expected. So the rest of the book takes off from there. Beginning with Watergate, reminding everybody, and I think with time that this has faded, just how great a constitutional crisis Watergate was. We get the impression in his time has faded that, well, maybe it wasn't so big a deal, maybe it was just Congress getting out of hand, maybe it was not just a cheap burglary, et cetera, et cetera. No, it was a constitutional, it was the greatest constitutional crisis in American history other than Reconstruction, since Reconstruction and the Civil War. The crimes of which President Nixon was accused and probably would have been convicted of had the House had the chance to go ahead with its impeachment proceedings, were true assaults on the Constitution of the United States. If you don't take my word for it, you can take William Safire's, who years later said as much. In fact, he said as much about the Watergate burglary, which was actually pretty minor. That was small potatoes in comparison to the rest of what was out there. With that having occurred, that constitutional crisis, the system supposedly worked. It was a pretty near thing, though. I mean, if it hadn't been for a night watchman at the Watergate, or if, you know, Carl Bernstein and Bob Woodward hadn't been quite so, you know, feisty, or if President Nixon had burned the tapes like he should have. There's such a thing as leaving too much for posterity. Even historians can say that from your own standpoint. But it happened, and out of that, much occurred. For one thing, it meant that the Republican Party was in very bad shape. It meant that the dynamics of politics that had begun under Nixon were going to change, and it meant that Gerald Ford was president. Ford, who wanted to heal the land, who was a moderate, or as he put it, he was a fiscal conservative, a social moderate, and in foreign policy was an internationalist, who faced enormous problems with the problem of stagflation, who adopted Nixon's foreign policy of detente, but who was slow to recognize a political earthquake to his right, the political earthquake that was Ronald Reagan, especially on foreign affairs. Not everybody in his administration was ignorant of this. Some were very aware of it. Some, indeed, were sympathetic to it and helped push the Ford administration steadily to the right. So far to the right that by the time he runs for re-election in 1976, President Ford announces that the word detente is no longer a word that he is ever going to use. Two of the people who were most important in that rightward push were his chief of staff and deputy chief of staff, who later became the chief of staff, who, as far as I can ascertain, and I'm pretty convinced of it, helped orchestrate what was later known as the Halloween Massacre. We all know about the Saturday Night Massacre of Nixon. This is the Halloween Massacre of Gerald Ford, in which Vice President Rockefeller was thrown off the ticket. Many changes were made. Kissinger was demoted. That was the people who had a lot to do. Oh, and one person was made Secretary of Defense, one of the people who was involved. Chief of Staff Donald Rumsfeld, helped along by his deputy, Richard B. Cheney. There's some continuities in this book that go from 1975 to recent events. And indeed, not so much Don Rumsfeld, but Dick Cheney does appear repeatedly in all sorts of interesting places. At any rate, the Ford administration managed to hang on and beat back a very, very strong threat from Ronald Reagan in the primaries in 1976, managed to hang on to win the nomination, but couldn't quite win the election, leaving the Reagan right in the Republican Party extremely strong, much stronger than ever, much stronger than it had been since 1964 when it was the Goldwater right. It wasn't inevitable that it was going to come to power, not by a long shot, but it was very strong politically. Ford was defeated by Jimmy Carter, as we know, who stood for two basic things. One is he was against politics. He was an anti-politician. He was a moralist. He thought that Watergate had shown that the old politics had to be gotten rid of. We needed a new kind of politics. He also said that he would never lie to the American people, which should have given people warning, actually. When a president says he's never going to lie, he probably won't be a strong president. Every strong president lies, period. Sometimes for the good, sometimes for the bad. But to take that kind of, Sherman statement about lying, that's not a good sign, in retrospect. An admirable stance, but given the realities of American politics, nothing you want to, you know, chain yourself to. He was also a Southern progressive, a moderate, who believed above all in efficiency, that efficiency would be the way to help liberate a government from its own follies. That stance, which helped catapult an unknown, hitherto unknown governor from Georgia to the top of American politics, was strong enough to win him the election barely over Gerald Ford. It also led him to alienate Congress, to alienate the left wing of his party, as well as the real left wing of his party, and showed that he was not really up to the challenges that faced him after he became president. To be sure, he enjoyed certain successes in getting the Panama Canal Treaty through, in the Camp David Accords, but his administration proved to be pretty much dismal across the board on domestic matters. You remember the Malaise speech from 1979, in which, for the first time in American history that I can recall, that I know of, maybe the only time in American history, where a president actually blamed the country's problems on the people themselves. One way not to be popular in America is to get up before the American people and say, you stink, or you're suffering, or you have malaise, or the country is going to hell. You're supposed to lead the country out of that. That's what a president's supposed to do. But Jimmy Carter didn't quite get that. he was listening to too many academics, I suspect, professors like me. And then, of course, you know, there was the Soviet invasion of Afghanistan, and then the Iranian hostage crisis. And, I mean, one begins to really feel bad for Jimmy Carter, actually. He found issues that were going to enable him to ward off the threat from the left within his own party, that is to say Ted Kennedy, but in so doing destroy himself for the general election, which is what he did, because nobody waves the flag better than Ronald Reagan. And so that's pretty much what happened. But I'm cutting a very long story short, just to focus on one key aspect of all of this. Well, two key aspects. One is Reagan's nomination was not inevitable. In fact, the establishment of the Republican Party had another candidate in mind altogether, whose name was George H.W. Bush. And George H.W. Bush actually did very well in early primaries, denounced Reagan's economic policy as voodoo economics, you remember? And, you know, he was sort of the establishment's boy, but it was not the establishment's year. It was Ronald Reagan's year, and especially after, he had tacked to the right first in North Carolina in 1976. In New Hampshire, he tacked to the right pretty hard and wins back the votes that he didn't get 4 years earlier. And by early spring, George H.W. Bush is gone. But Ronald Reagan did an amazing thing in retrospect again in Detroit at the convention, which is when he named Bush his vice presidential candidate, thereby solidifying a marriage between the new right of the Republican Party and the old establishment of the Republican Party that has lasted until now. And that was by no means, I mean, Reagan didn't like Bush a whole lot. He thought he was, you know, he melted under pressure. He was sort of a wimp. His wife had a very choice nickname for him, which I forget at the moment, but you can find it in your galleys. that's point number one. Point number two is that by 1980, liberalism had basically disintegrated as a presidential, as a national political force. It would remain very important in Congress for a very long time. But it had been disintegrating since the late 1960s under the pressure of Vietnam, where the left of the party was against the anti-war wing of the party and the, what should we say, the pro-war wing of the party or the not anti-wing, the anti-anti-war wing of the party, really divided very, very sharply. That's why there was blood in the streets of Chicago in 1968, the 68 convention. There were also divisions over civil rights. The old segregationist, racist, white, South Democratic Party was quickly disappearing and being, as their members first went to George Wallace and then went to the Republican Party. But there were still elements of moderation in the South, the border states, that were not Wallaceite, but they were not, you know, they were not the new kind of liberalism either. And the Democratic Party and liberalism, they had been part of liberalism, was really falling apart. They also suffered from a case of really bad false optimism after Watergate. They thought, oh boy, Richard Nixon has finally done what we always thought he would do. From the time that he came into politics in 1946, we thought he'd want to become a dictator, and he tried to do so. So they thought that the Democratic Party would rule forever and ever thereafter. World without end, amen. and moved actually to the left. Didn't work out that way. It was Jimmy Carter who managed to get elected, a president who had no ties to any faction in the party, but who disappointed every faction just about equally. And you kind of saw, I think, the decrepitude to which liberalism had fallen in the Kennedy campaign for the nomination in 1980, which, you know, for liberals it sounded great, but he was proposing basically old solutions. He wasn't quite sure why he was running, except that he wanted to be president, and that he held up a family and a torch, which he believed in very, very deeply, but was kind of ran a fairly forlorn campaign until the end, and not that Carter ran such a great one, but he was doomed pretty much from the start, leaving the party pretty badly split. And so came the ascension of Ronald Reagan. Now, I say a lot about Ronald Reagan in this book. You all know his background. Ronald Reagan was a man who spent his entire life becoming someone else. You know, that's what actors do. But more than that, he started off, you know, in Tempe. He came from really nothing. His father was kind of the town drunk, worked for the New Deal, actually. Worked for, I think, the WPA. Which his son later took to be an example of how bad, you know, that example of how bad big government can be. I won't go through the whole story, but it is an extraordinary one. Of a man who became something else, a man who was very much on the left, who in the 1930s, in fact, was so far on the left that some thought of him as a fellow traveler of the Communist Party, later becoming a very strong right-wing conservative, but one who was always very, very shrewd and very, very much a politician. He was not half the ideologue that his supporters and his detractors thought he was. He was a guy who understood that sometimes you have to take a step backwards to take two steps forwards towards your goal. He knew how to compromise. He knew how to appear to be non-ideological even when he was being deeply ideological. And there was a part of him that I think actually was his old liberal self, traces of it, that remained and helped contribute, I think, to make him, and this is where some of people will think this coming from me will be odd, make him truly one of the great presidents in American history. And I'll explain that briefly before I open it up to questions. Reagan was special because he he had a myth. He wove a myth around him, the myth of Reaganism, which no other right-wing Republican had ever managed to do. It was a myth that went beyond being avuncular, beyond being friendly, beyond being, you know, a great communicator. It was a series of ideals and ideas and emotions which tapped into exactly what many, many Americans were feeling at 1980 and gave them something that they, if they didn't fall for it, if they didn't believe every bit of policy, which they didn't, in fact. When you ask, one of the great, you know, conundrums about Reagan and Reaganism is that, you know, he everybody loved him, but they didn't like his policies very much. You know, his policies always polled pretty badly, except for foreign policy. But they loved him. Or many people loved him. He also ended up being the most polarizing president in our history. But what was it about him that they loved? Well, he had this mythos that combined two seemingly contradictory things, the communalism of home and the individualism of the frontier and of risk. And he managed to put those two things together in an American mode that projected the great destroyer of both individuals and of home and of communities as big government. It was a nostalgic view of America. It was a nostalgic view of life. But this was an age that was pretty nostalgic across the board. I mean, when Teddy Kennedy said, "The dream shall never die," that was nostalgic. When Jimmy Carter was talking about restoring moral purity in America, in the America of the 1970s, you know, the America of disco, in America where he's preaching moral purity in the pages of Playboy magazine, this is nostalgic. So nostalgia was out there, I think, because of Vietnam and because of the reaction to Watergate and because people were disoriented, so they were looking for something familiar, and they latched on to a number of different familiar things, and they latched on to Ronald Reagan above all. So this is what he had going for him and got him through, even when his policies were unpopular, calling for envisaging a free citizenry that was drawn to where it could go and begin the world all over again, begin their lives all over again, make its dreams come true, just like Ronald Reagan had. It was, in part, a product of his optimistic temperament. I don't want to say that that's not important at all, but it went beyond it. It transcended it. And it had to do, in part, with his political skills. His political skill, above all, at transforming right-wing Republicanism into Reaganism. Two very different things. And one reason why every Republican today is saying, "I'm just like Ronald Reagan," even when they're not. None of them are. But he managed to do something which nobody else could do, creating an outgoing, energizing, even, and this is another oddity given the rise of the Christian right within his coalition, even a sensuous ideal. I mean, he's California. He's a divorced guy who never goes to church. Even sensuous ideal of a bountiful, limitless American future open to everyone who was determined to succeed. If you weren't determined to succeed, forget it. Which in Ronald Reagan's, not in Ronald Reagan's eyes, but in the eyes of many of his supporters, meant just about every black American. Because, you know, we all know that black Americans aren't real. Well, some are. But, you know, most aren't. Why? Not because they're inferior, but because the welfare system keeps them that way. So it's liberalism that's the enemy, always. That's another move that Ronald Reagan makes. He never blames, he's not George Wallace. He attacks liberalism. Now, when you open your campaign in 1980 in Philadelphia, Mississippi, where three civil rights workers were killed in 1964, and you just give a speech in favor of state rights, I know there's been an argument about this in the New York Times lately. Everybody got the message down south. Everybody got the message. If you just read through the editorials right there after things flip, he's a Yankee, he's a good Yankee, he's our Yankee. How did I get off on that? I'm not quite sure. How I got off on that was that the blend of, but Reaganism itself would have been nothing without the decay of liberalism. That the two went together. That with liberalism falling apart as a political coalition as well as an set of ideas, Reaganism was able to sweep all before it with very little opposition. And that's what happened. And the political genius behind Ronald Reagan and the and then what happened to Ronald Reagan and his coalition really covered the rest of the book. How did Reagan do in my estimation? What did he do? Why does he deserve to be known as one of the greatest presidents? Well, let's back up. I think he did a lot of damage, an extraordinary amount of damage to this country. I think his policies were, and they're still being worked out, really, in terms of the judiciary, but his policies in terms of economic inequality, in terms of changing the tax system around, civil rights, in which he had a regressive regressive domestic policy. The first half, actually, of his first administration's foreign policy, which caused a bloodbath in Central America. I mean, I can go on and on and on. And in fact, the book does go on and on and on with everything that Ronald Reagan did that was wrongheaded. He did succeed in getting the tax rate done. I mean, you know, any president who begins his term with the top marginal rate at 70% and leaves with it at 35% is an effective president, whether you like it or not. That's effective. And it's never going back up to 70 again, not in my lifetime. It's just not going to happen. It helped turn politics into, you know, one where if you call for higher taxes, you're not going to get elected in large parts of the country. Why that is something else I go into in the book. So with all this litany of disasters, why do I say that Ronald Reagan deserves to be known as one of the great presidents? For two reasons. The most important has to do with the Cold War. Ronald Reagan came to office as a hidebound, right-wing, roll-back, Goldwater Republican, against the theory of containment that George Kennedy had come up, the bipartisan idea that had ruled American foreign policy from the end of World War II on. He was against it. He thought that America should be much more aggressive, that America had to exert military superiority, not military parity, with the Soviet Union, and had to win the Cold War. You know, he said to Richard Allen very early on, who was later one of his national security advisors, "What is my view of the Cold War? Two words: we win." What do you think of that? He said. And many of his supporters have said that he had this in mind from the very beginning, that he was going to bankrupt the Soviet Union, that he had devised the Strategic Defense Initiative in order to do that, and he knew what he was doing all along, and it all worked out. That's not true. What did happen, though, was that Ronald Reagan, after being pushed in part by a man who's, my estimation of his risen, Secretary of State George Shultz, and it's risen not just because he went to Princeton, and not just because he's rumored to have a tiger tattooed on his posterior. He understood something about the way that the Soviet Union and the United States might actually come to not just arms control agreements, but arms reduction agreements. And he actually got the ball rolling. But nothing was, and this all actually happens while, you know, the Soviet Union is still being ruled by people like Chernenko, you know, and Andropov. I mean, this is not, you know, the beginning of the Gorbachev unfreezing of the Soviet Union. But what made Reagan extraordinary was that he was able to recognize Gorbachev for what he was, in a way that I don't think most people around him were willing to do. In fact, most people around him were not willing to do. If you go back and you read, everybody is involved in arms control. Everybody's involved, with the exception of his ambassador to the Soviet Union, Jack Matlock, and George Shultz. Everybody is suspicious, either from a realist standpoint, the Bush faction, or from a moralistic right-wing standpoint. If you read my dear friend George Will's columns from those days, you see him saying, you know, this is awful. Charles Krauthammer, my former colleague at the New Republic, you know, talked about Gorby mania. We shouldn't fall for Gorby mania. Indeed, there were some who were attacking Reagan himself as, I think Howard Phillips put it this way, as a useful tool of the Stalinists, as a useful idiot. Actually, that's an old Stalinist phrase, so it's double whammy. But anyway. You know, that he was just doing the Kremlin's bidding. Why? Because he had a very strong staff and a very strong wife. One forgets that Nancy Reagan was kind of the Hillary Clinton of her time. I mean, she was accused of being the most manipulative, behind-the-scenes person. You know, if you trot out some of the things said about Nancy Reagan and match them up with what was said about Hillary during healthcare, they're actually the same. So the press needs to get new, you know, buttons on its computers or something, because it's the same. In fact, she did have something of an impact, but not as much as people let on. So Reagan recognized this, and that is an extraordinary thing. And that's really why I give him the high marks that I do. Why? When you tote up accomplishments by American presidents in all of American history, but especially since 1945, ending the Cold War has to rank right up there. I mean, I grew up in an age when we were not sure whether we'd be alive the next day. You know, any of us who lived through the Cuban Missile Crisis know that. And for all of, as much as I admire how President Kennedy handled that crisis, he did not end the Cold War. He was not in a position to do so. Sometimes greatness comes to people. Ronald Reagan did understand that and understood it in a way that nobody else around him was willing to do, and I think for that he is to be honored by posterity. And I don't think it's a zero-sum game. You know, I just think that that was an extraordinary thing that should never be forgotten, and we should always honor him for that. That doesn't mean that you can't, you know, criticize him too. But you see, this is what history is about. History is always about being able to hold two contradictory ideas in your head at the same time. You know, we don't have to think people are saints to do them honor. In fact, thinking of politicians and saints as saints is usually a dishonor, because it overlooks the flaws that we all have as human beings. It overlooks the bad that we all bring to our lives as well as the good. And it ignores how good can out. And that's what makes a person extraordinary, at least in my view, as an old historian. Okay, so where we went from there, what happened to Reagan, how it all culminated in George W. Bush, that's the rest of the book. But I'm going to close with what was the turning point. And I'll just read this very quickly. It's the epilogue to the book, the beginning of the epilogue to the book, which, as I say, the book actually now ends, thanks to my dear, dear, wonderful helpers and friends and editors, including Tim Dugan, who is in the room at HarperCollins, who has published this book with. I don't often give plugs for my publishers, but I do want to give a plug for this publisher. This book will now end with the nomination of John McCain by the Republican Party. And the Democrats still unclear. I had to rewrite the ending. Those of you who have read the ending, just trash it. It's different. But the epilogue begins, and I'll end with this, with a very different world. It ends on October 13th, 2001. Pretty much at the same place where we began in Lower Manhattan, but not with the tall ships. On the side streets of Lower Broadway, immigrant vendors sold little, thin cloth stars and stripes, fastened to sticks. Barely a month after the attacks, the shock had receded just slightly, and on this Saturday, hushed throngs headed toward the Battery to get as close to the still smoldering mountain of death as the police would permit. The estimated count of the slain at the World Trade Center as of now stood at between 4,500 and 5,000, roughly double the number of Americans killed at Pearl Harbor on December 7, 1941. But these dead, unlike those at Pearl Harbor, were almost all civilians. Federal officials had released details about the cockpit voice recorder tape retrieved from the wreckage of United Airlines Flight 93 in Pennsylvania, with its sounds of a wild and desperate struggle just before the plane went down. The White House had announced that it was going to give half of the $5.1 billion in emergency relief approved by Congress to the Defense Department for improving intelligence and for repairing damage that the third squad of terrorist hijackers had inflicted on the Pentagon building. But the devastation in Lower Manhattan remained the focus of the shock, grief, and patriotism. And here's where things have changed. Almost exactly a quarter century earlier, during the bicentennial celebrations, revelers had swarmed through these same New York streets, joyously waving little American flags, craning their necks to see the tall ships in the harbor, enjoying what President Ford called a super 4th of July beneath the immense twin towers that now are no more. Back then, in 1976, the feeling of national pride seemed manic, a little artificial, yet sincere, as if the celebrators were relieved and energized to discover that a common bond had survived the furious struggles over civil rights and Vietnam, and the political trauma of Watergate. Now the feeling was somber and frightened, a common bond caused by trauma, by fury, and also by fear. Not just fear that the terrorists might strike again at any moment, but fear that the world had changed forever and nobody was prepared. That was the beginning of the end of the age of Reagan. But we had to live through an administration which was a turbocharged version of Reagan before we got there. That's how the book ends, and I think that's where I'll end for tonight. And thank you all very much. You've been a wonderful, patient audience. And I'm happy to take questions, and I thank you all very much. Ma'am. I didn't do the second one, the first one? Okay, the question is, maybe I overlooked this. There were two reasons why Reagan was a great president, and I only mentioned one of them. And I say he was a great president. What I think he did was open up the possibilities for, how to put it, in the aftermath of what I think was a pretty disastrous Carter administration in the end, he gave Americans at least an implication of hope. Now, we would disagree about what hope would be for, and that would happen all the way along. But in his nostalgic, Reaganite, mythic way, he opened up a possibility which I think has affected American politics not completely for the bad. In some ways for the good. At a time when liberalism had to rediscover itself and had failed, really, to reawaken itself. In some ways, Ronald Reagan, and this is going to get me in a lot of trouble with my Democratic friends, and I'm a Democrat, so that's a lot of my friends. In some ways, Ronald Reagan managed to carry some of the rhetoric, and that's just true. He just, steals. Ronald Reagan is a thief. If Barack Obama is a stealing, nothing compared to Ronald Reagan. And Ronald Reagan, he sometimes credited people, but lots of times he didn't. I mean, who else would get up and say, my fellow Americans, we have a rendezvous with destiny with a straight face? I mean, there are some of us who have read enough and some of us in this room old enough to remember who said that first. But he carried some of the rhetoric and, indeed, I think some of the spirit of Franklin Delano Roosevelt, who was his great hero as a young man. I mean, he used to try to imitate Franklin Delano Roosevelt. His brother talks about this all the time, out there in Illinois. And of John F. Kennedy. One forgets that John F. Kennedy on the Cold War was a real Cold Warrior. I mean, he believed in national greatness. And I think that at a time when the country was in need of something, Ronald Reagan did that. He didn't do it in the way I would have preferred, but he did it. So that was the other great thing that I think he did. Yes, ma'am.
Apropos of Reagan and Gorbachev,
mm-hmm.
if my memory serves me correctly, Margaret Thatcher
yes.
was actually the first person who said we could do business with this man. Now, given her interaction with Reagan, was there any kind of mutual influence there?
There certainly was. And Margaret Thatcher, I don't say enough about that in the book. But yes, and you quoted her almost word for word exactly. She said that we can do business with this man. She recognized him as well, in part because before he became General Secretary of the Communist Party in Soviet Union, he had visited London. He had visited her. He had visited others. So she had taken his measure before he actually had power, and saw that he was the real deal, or at least showed signs of being the real deal. I mean, he was a communist. He wanted to save communism. He didn't want to bring capitalism to Russia. He thought that capitalism was exploitation and terrible. But he saw that, its days were numbered. Communism's days were numbered unless they changed things dramatically. And he was telling that to Thatcher. But it's true that Thatcher was one of the reasons why Reagan was able to be as firm as he was. There's no question about that. He was surrounded not by Margaret Thatcher's, but by his own people. So that's why I give him a lot of credit for that. Then again, you know, remember also, he and Thatcher did not always see eye to eye. I mean, on Grenada, for example, she was very much against our invasion of Grenada. And there were lots of ways in which, you know, especially on foreign policy, they didn't get along. So he might not have automatically listened to her. The fact that he listened to her rather than listening to his own people, I think, is a credit to him. Yeah, sir. Well, I mean, Zbigniew Brzezinski would like you to believe that. Afghanistan, no question. I mean, even before Gorbachev took power, he was saying that this was a terrible mistake. It, you know, a bleeding wound. We have to get rid of it. And one of the stories in the Soviet archives, which I didn't consult, but I know people who have, is about the running battle between, you know, within the Politburo and within the Kremlin over what to do about Afghanistan. And there are hawks and doves, and you know, and Gorbachev is a dove, and he wanted to end it long before he could have. One of the things about the Charlie Wilson film, although you know, it's a fun film. I mean, you know, congressmen in hot tubs. I mean, what could be bad? Well, I can think of other things that are better, actually, now that I think about it. But that was pretty late in the game. And I actually knew the people. I mean, I know I'm very good friends. One of the guys who helped advise me on this book was very close to Charlie Wilson, very conservative Republican named Mickey Edwards. And that was late in the game. I mean, by 87, 88, Gorbachev was just trying his best to get out of there. So I give Gorbachev some of the credit, too. I mean, the idea that Americans, that everything that Russia did was because Americans did it is, I think, not to give, you know, I mean, Russia's Russia. And we didn't force them to do everything. There were forces within there that wanted to change things. So, but no, without question, you know, these other things were there, too. And our decision to go after, to supply the Mujahideen, it had a tremendous effect. The problem, of course, is the blowback. I mean, it's only going to be a matter of time before some of those guys are not aiming those Stinger missiles at the Russians, and they're not aiming Stinger missiles. They're aiming American 747s. Yes, ma'am.
Professor Hollins, can you tell us a little bit about your research? You mentioned that you didn't do personal interviews.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of these people were around, and I'm sure you could have interviewed
them.
Why?
Right. My view was, if you interview one person, you have to interview them all. That was number one. And then I'd never get the book done. And Tim would have been very angry with me. You know, they're all alive. I mean, especially if I'm taking it up to today, I'd have to interview everybody in this room. Some people in this room. It would have been an endless task. That was number one. Number two, I don't trust interviews for historians. I trust certain kinds of interviews. I trust, you know, if you have to find out the history of people who don't leave many written records behind. If you want to write the history of, I don't know, of sharecroppers or of working people or things like that. Yeah, I mean, they can be very, very valuable. But I'm more distrustful. I'm of the, I don't know, I guess the I.F. Stone school, which is you don't talk to anybody, you just read what they write. And usually that's more accurate than what they tell you. I've done interviews. I've interviewed political leaders, and I must say, I know what it's like to be seduced by a politician. I don't know enough about what's. Never mind. I'm not going there. When I say seduced, all I mean is that there's a play of imagination, there's a dance of subjectivities between an interviewer and an interviewee, which has to be checked. And you can't check it by, you know, interviewing everybody. You come to your own conclusions. I mean, it could be subliminal. Someone's wearing a nice tie or a nice dress or the right pumps. Or, you know, I don't know. I just don't want to go near that. I'm not trained to do that. I'm trained to read dead people's mail. That's what I'm trained to do. And, you know, they're not dead yet, not all of them. But there's a lot of mail, and there's a lot of stuff, and there's plenty to figure it out. I did include one conversation which I couldn't exclude because I admire the man so much that, and we were having drinks a year ago in the spring? No, 2 years ago. No, maybe it's just a year ago. A year ago. And he's Adam Michnik who was involved in Solidarity in Poland and was jailed for his troubles and is an extraordinary, he's just a hero of mine. So I said, well, I get to quote one guy. And actually, he had very interesting things to say about how Reagan was regarded in Poland by the the young left-wing 68er kids. They all thought that Reagan was great. Well, Adam said they were all great while we were in prison. Then we got out of prison. We saw what he really stood for. Then we were a little bit more nervous. But that, I'll let Adam speak for himself. So that's number one. Number two, the question is difficult, though. I mean, even if you exclude all the interviews, in November 2001, the President of the United States basically gutted the Presidential Papers Act and made it very, very difficult for historians to get a hold of presidential papers beginning in 1981. When the president who signed that executive order, when his father was the Vice President of the United States. So it's very hard to get anything after that. But there's some stuff around, and I found more than I thought I was going to, in part because of Freedom of Information Act suits that had been lodged before the directive came down. They had to respect those. And then once that stuff is made public, it has to be made public to everybody. Excuse me. So I found some very, very interesting things about the Bork hearings, for example, that I didn't think I was going to find. And I found some interesting things about not much about Clinton, because the Clinton stuff hasn't even been organized. A few things in the first Bush administration that I thought were, interesting. Some stuff in the Reagan administration as well. I didn't realize that Reagan was consulting with Nixon as much as he was, actually, especially in the second term. There's a lot of letters back and forth. And Nixon's letters are, there's a letter from Nixon to Reagan after Iran-Contra that's just hilarious, about how to handle a scandal. It's just hilarious. It's just hilarious. But now I should add, however, the best of the modern presidential papers, well, the Kennedy Library is terrific, and the Johnson Library is very good. In my period, the Gerald Ford Library is fantastic. I mean, I really give high marks to not only the National Archives and Records Administration, but just the people there. Now, it's true, it was only a couple of years, so it's a little easier to do a short administration. They really have gotten everything up, and it's very accessible. You can get it online, half of it. I mean, not half of it, but a lot of it. And there, located my favorite archival find was the Richard Bruce Cheney papers as Deputy Chief of Staff and then Chief of Staff in the Ford administration. And, I'll put it as neutrally as I can. The Dick Cheney that you see in those papers is the Dick Cheney you see today. Yes. And that's what's extraordinary. He's the nice guy who got along, and he is, I suppose. But the political stuff, what his reaction to Watergate, for example, was that it was all a congressional plot. It was simply a power grab by the Congress, and he was doing his best to make sure that Congress never did anything like that again. And the War Powers Act had preceded it. And there's all sorts of, I mean, should I give it away, Tim? I'll give one away. He wants to break into Cy Hirsch's apartment at one point. Not a real good idea. There's a certain Nixonian aspect to it. But the thing that I thought that made me laugh out loud, it may not make you laugh out loud, but made me. This is 1975. They were getting rid of the head of the CIA because the head of the CIA had cooperated with Congress. His name was William Colby. And he had cooperated with the investigations of the CIA, which later led to the famous Church Committee report and Pike Committee reports. So, he's a dead duck. Everybody's, even Ford says, forget it. He's disloyal. We've got to get rid of him. We can't have a man like that as the CIA. But it takes a while. They don't get rid of him until the Saturday night, the Halloween massacre. But they start asking around. So Ford and Rumsfeld, and this is all in the Cheney papers, Ford and Rumsfeld are given the charge to find a new head of the CIA. And there are lots of candidates. George H.W. Bush is a candidate. He's in China at that point. He actually is going to get the job eventually. But Rumsfeld forwards, and there's one guy who's named by only three people. They ask a bunch of people, more than five, less than, about eight people. But there's one guy who's only named by three, but who really shoots to the top of the Rumsfeld Cheney list, which is given to Ford. And that is a person who's described in the little biography of him as, well, you know, he's not been involved in intelligence. In fact, he's never run anything, really. He's never been in charge of any department. But he's a strong team player. And his name was Robert Bork, was Solicitor General of the United States, who had been best known for having been the guy who actually finished the Saturday Night Massacre to get rid of Archibald Cox in 1973. That's why I love research. And you can be sure that that ended up in here. Yeah, sir.
Mm-hmm. I'm remembering at the end of the Carter administration, you had 13% inflation, 20% interest rates, and this dramatic cut in marginal tax rates arguably ushered in a period of growth and prosperity that gave the United States a much higher growth rate than any other G7 country over the 25-year period. I just wonder why you haven't emphasized
Yeah, I don't emphasize it because I think it's a mixed picture, not that it's a bleak picture only. No question that, I mean, inflation goes way down. I mean, inflation was at 13-14%, as you say, it was cut in half. Unemployment actually eventually comes down. There's a Reagan recession in 82, and then, you know, unemployment goes up to 10%, but then eventually comes down. Lots of the basic signs for economic health are much better by the time Reagan leaves office than by the time than when he took office. The question is why, number one. And the why is not so clear. First of all, in terms of growth, actually, it's interesting. Annual GDP growth is actually slower under Reagan than it was under Carter. Seems impossible. But that, just that one statistic, it's true. You don't get the productivity route, you know. That's the point. So the point is he breaks inflation's back. Now, how does that happen? That happens because Paul Volcker's the head of the Fed. And Paul Volcker actually been appointed head of the Fed by Jimmy Carter. And he takes a very, you know, monetarist view. He just says, you know, I'm sending interest rates up to 19.75%, and we're going to get rid of inflation, and we're going to cause a recession. And that's going to break the back of inflation, and it worked. And then coming out of the recession, you know, things indeed got better. Now, do you credit, and by the way, Carter's approved of this. So, and Reagan continued it. So, you know, who deserves the credit, well, or blame, or whatever. I'm not so sure that it's only Reagan's. And I don't think that the tax cuts were responsible for it. What the tax cuts primarily did was twofold, it seems to me. They really increased the deficit so that he had to raise taxes thereafter three or four times. He called them revenue enhancements, but they were tax rises. You know, they made the American rich, richer than ever before. I mean, how many millionaires were there in 1980? How many millionaires were there by 1988? A lot of that had to do with the taxes. It wasn't just economic growth, because economic growth wasn't so high. And it certainly wasn't because of investment, because the rate of investment didn't increase in the way that it was supposed to have. I mean, the supply side thing just didn't work out. The economy grew, however, and, you know, and I want to give Reagan credit for that. I do give Reagan credit for that. I mean, it's not as if he deserves no credit. What I find in this book is I give credit to Ronald Reagan for everything that the people who love him never give him credit for. And I don't give him any credit for all the things they say they did. You know, like he single-handedly won the Cold War. Wrong. But he did a lot. He whipped inflation. He whipped the economic doldrums by cutting taxes. Wrong, but the economy is a lot better. But I think in the end, what I said before, the answer to the question about national spirit, in all of these things, that happened, and it was in part because of the mythos and in part because of fact, and the blend of the two was what made him what he was. I should add, though, on the economy. Look, I mean, if you were in the bottom quarter of the American, you know, not wealth. Well, wealth is one thing, but income, household income, you stagnated or you declined. I mean, it was not a growth that was, you know, even across the board. I know there are figures that can show that it did look that way. But basically, average hourly wages fell for a lot of for the bottom part of the economy, and it was certainly not even across gender lines, racial lines. I mean, it just wasn't. It wasn't general in the way that the Clinton. I mean, one of the things that Clinton deserves some credit for is his boom was general. You know, every segment of the population actually did better. That wasn't true under Reagan. By the time Reagan leaves office, rates of inequality are approaching those of the 1920s or even the Gilded Age. He also, you know, did more to destroy the labor movement than anybody else. Whatever you think of the labor movement, but you know, the Patco strike was really important. Not for Patco so much as for what it did. I mean, and the changes in labor laws and the non-enforcement of labor laws. It shifted the new. In that respect, he shifted things tremendously. I think actually. So these are all economic effects, but they're not necessarily things that you associate with, you know, everybody doing very much better than they had before.
Part of the legacy of Reagan is this missile defense system, which seems to never die.
Yes.
Did he believe
yes.
the story that he promoted to
yes.
the world?
Yes, he did. You know, Edward Teller told him it was true, so he believed it. Also, Reagan had this. This is part of the goofy part about Reagan. There's a lot of goofiness to Ronald Reagan, by the way, and including the things that I admire about him. I mean, the things that I admire had goofy origins. Two examples. One of them is the SDI. I mean, he had this great love of gadgets. He thought that the world would be solved by gadgets. He believed, you know, the General Electric. I mean, he believed it. You know, we're all going to be, you know, a world of progress. Gadget, gadget, gadget. And he believed that, you know, he had that sense that that was something that could happen, and he was primed for it. What was the other? Oh, the other goofy thing was this is what Colin Powell said. Oh God, here come the little green men again. When he was talking, he actually in a speech to the United Nations, he talks about this. He doesn't refer to the movie by name, but the movie is The Day the Earth Stood Still, which is a story about how basically a bunch of aliens invade Earth. And threaten to destroy the place unless the whole world disarms and gets rid of nuclear weapons. So Reagan gives a speech in which he, you know, basically cites, you know, what would happen if an alien ever came and made us? Wouldn't they? It was weird. And so here's Colin. Oh no, here they come again, the little green aliens. What I will say on Reagan's behalf about that, though, is that he, unlike the rest of the Republican right, as far as I can make out, and George Shultz and a few others, but you know, of the hard, hard right, he was one of the few, if one of the few, to actually be able to imagine a world after the Cold War. You know, he gives this speech towards the end where he talks about, you know, Yvonne and, you know, Betty going off into the sunset together. I mean, he had this, you know, sort of almost, you know, childlike, well, I don't want to say, a child story kind of way of talking about world brotherhood, one world. This is, you know, this is right out of the schmaltzy 19th, you know, it's one worldism. You know, it could be Wendell Willkie. It could be, you know, Henry Wallace. In fact, he voted for Truman in 48, but, you know, a lot of his friends voted for Henry Wallace. There was that side to Reagan, which always remained recessive later on. You never heard about it much, but it was there. And it comes out in these speeches. And it's wild. But, you know, you can see, like, Frank Gaffney. I mean, all of the people who are the hard-nosed people around him really don't like this. Not that they want to blow the world up, but they think that this is a sign of weakness. That this is a sign that you're going to give in to the Reds, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And, but Reagan said, you know, no. I want the world. I think that the Russians and the Americans can all get along. It's sort of the Rodney King view of, you know, we can get along. Can't we all get along? He had that view. It was kind of, what should we say? These days people would say it's naive, right? But, and the view may have been naive, but he had the political fortitude, will, and intelligence to back it up. So he was able to do what he was able to do. He was able to get an IMF treaty, which I don't think anybody else would have been willing to do, including George H.W. Bush, because he was, you know, inherently distrustful. He later changed. He later actually opened up himself to Gorbachev and others, and he, you know, reunified Germany and did other things which were okay. He had a war which was not so hot, but that's another matter. That's another administration coming down the pike. Anything else? Any other questions? Yes, ma'am.
Do you think that
Okay, those are two questions. The first question is my struggle over Reagan's blend of goofiness or simplicity and intelligence, high intelligence, political intelligence. And how did I, you know, whoever said that a president of the United States had to be intelligent? I think a president of the United States better be intelligent. He may not be learned. Many learned presidents have not succeeded. But, you know, you don't necessarily, but you better be intelligent. And I think Reagan was vastly underestimated. By his friends and his supporters and his detractors alike. He used it very shrewdly, though. I mean, during the Iran-Contra scandal, where he was, may I say, guilty as sin, and this is something else you get from the papers, I mean, and from his diaries. I mean, he was guilty as sin. So when he is accused of this, well, you know, I just didn't know what was going on. You know, he played up to all of the stuff that the liberals were saying about him. I'm just a doddering old fool, so I guess it didn't matter, but I did it against my own will. You know, he knew, he was really, that was brilliant. I mean, that was, if you're just admiring political maneuvering, that was brilliant. And he got off scot-free. It was bad for the Constitution, but it was okay for other things. It was worth looking at. So I think that Reagan was a blend, but I, you know, a certain degree of naive idealism is okay by me, as long as you don't, you know, think that it's the totality of what you're doing, and as long as you have the intelligence. And I think Reagan was an extremely intelligent man, and a very well-read man. I mean, a lot of what he read was kind of crackpot, but it wasn't just that. He read, you know, von Hayek. He'd read all of this stuff. He'd read the classics of political theory. He knew this stuff. He wasn't just a movie actor. Our prejudice against movie actors. He was more intelligent than most movie actors, I suspect. And the second question was, remind me, quickly. Another president, greatness. Yes. When I said that greatness came to Reagan, I didn't mean that he didn't meet it halfway. What I meant was, and Bill Clinton has said this too, that certain presidents are given the chance to lead and certain presidents aren't. And, you know, poor Clinton, you know, says that he never really had the chance to lead. Well, you know, he did all right for what he did, but he also didn't do so well and blah, blah, blah. But he didn't have the opportunity that Ronald Reagan had. And he certainly didn't have the opportunity that the current president had. The current president had as great a chance as anybody since FDR. Well, I guess Reagan too, of the Cold War. But FDR, Lincoln, Lincoln, you know, Lincoln was given an opportunity and looked at him like a curse. You know, when he took office, you know, March 4th, 1861, the day before, he turned to all the reporters who had been following him around and said, well, boys, you know, now your troubles are over and mine are just beginning. You know, he wasn't looking forward to, taking over a country that was split in half. But he, you know, there are presidents who rise to the occasion and there are presidents who fall to the occasion. And I think that the Abraham Lincoln and, to an extent, Ronald Reagan, in certain ways, rose to the occasion. I think the current president has fallen to the occasion. And on that, quickly.
Away from the book and away from the research you do for your writing.
Yes.
What do you read?
Oh, man. When I've got the time, I read anything I can get my hands on. I'm like the guy who reads the kid who read the Cheerios box, right? I'm a typophile, if that's a word. I just read anything I can get my hands on. But this summer, I've been writing a lot lately. This summer, there's a new edition of War and Peace that's just come out, and I can't wait to get my hands on it, because I haven't read War and Peace since I was in college, and I really, really, really look forward to that. Middle March 2, that's the next. I'm going to go back and read all the old stuff that I haven't read in a while. But we can talk more about good books later. I'm always eager to hear about new ones. Thank you all very, very much.